You're listening to Midori House, live from Berlin, first broadcast on the 21st of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to this special edition of Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Berlin, with me, Tom Edwards, and Kimberly Bradley. Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
Quentin Pio, Berlin bureau chief of the Financial Times, joins us to reflect on the current role of Germany in Europe.
And feeling tired? Well, maybe you need to check into Berlin's newest attraction for the chronically sleep-deprived.
We have an inner clock that tells us to be awake during the daytime, in the evening time to calm down and to get tired and to go to bed and sleep. And a lot of people got out of touch with that inner clock.
And as the curtain falls on the Berlin Film Festival, the head of Monocle Film, Gillian Tobias, sits down with Charlie Wupken, president and CEO of the legendary Babelsberg Film Studios.
Filmmaking still is a handcraft business, and you need to transport that business from one generation to the other. And that has happened in Babelsberg and never got lost, fortunately.
All that and so much more to come in the next hour here on this very special edition of Midori House, live from the heart of Berlin. But first, let's head back over to London to catch up on the latest news from around the world with David Spencer.
South African police have replaced the lead detective handling the Oscar Pistorius investigation. Hilton Botha was removed from the case after it was revealed he faces seven counts of attempted murder over an incident in 2009. Botha's handling of the investigation was criticised by defence lawyers, claiming he'd made several fundamental mistakes. The athlete denies murdering his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, saying that he shot her in error, thinking she was an intruder. Criminal lawyer Elna Mulman thinks police have handled the case clumsily.
Surely they should have been prepared and aware of the fact that the matter of Botha is going to be reinstated. So I would assume that they would have dealt with it in a more professional manner in at least mentioning that or bringing that up before and, you know, just not dealing with it as a surprise.
The bail hearing is set to conclude tomorrow. Dozens of people have been killed after a massive car bomb explosion in the Syrian capital, Damascus. State media blamed what it called terrorists battling President Bashar al-Assad for the blast. It came as Britain announced another $17 million in aid to help those displaced by the violence in Syria. British Foreign Secretary William Hague said today's blast underlined the need for help.
We regret all loss of life in Syria. There are hundreds of people dying every day. And this is the result of the conflict not being resolved, of a regime that has targeted and abused so many of its own people.
At least 11 people have been killed in a pair of explosions in the Indian city of Hyderabad. The blast happened 10 minutes apart near a crowded market area. Dozens more people were injured in the explosions. Three people have died after gunshots fired from a car in Las Vegas forced a Maserati to crash into a taxi, creating a fireball. Several people were also injured. Initial reports of a gun battle are being played down by police, who are hunting the occupants of a black Range Rover where the gunshots are said to have come from. 30,000 workers have staged a demonstration in Brussels against austerity measures planned by the Belgian government. Expressing anger at wage cuts and tax rises, they marched across the city in one of the biggest protests to take place over budget restrictions. France has described as ignorant comments from a leading US businessman essentially describing French workers as lazy. The head of tyre company Titan International, Maurice Taylor, said he would have to be stupid to buy out a French factory where staff only work 3 hours a day. He was replying in a letter to a request for Titan to consider investing in a Goodyear site in Amiens. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. It's 4 minutes past the hour here in Berlin. We're in the salubrious surroundings of Paulie Sal, myself, and Kimberly Bradley. Kimberly, we're here to sort of celebrate Monocle's new issue. This Plenty to look forward to in today's show. Are you fired up and ready to go?
I'm fired up and ready to go. And Polyzal is one of the best locations in the city to do this, I think.
Well, we should tell our listeners a little bit about Polyzal, shouldn't we? It's a really incredible place. We're in the sort of bar area here in Polyzal. It used to be a Jewish girls' school, and it's had a very sort of complex history, hasn't it?
The building was actually built in the 1930s as a Jewish girls' school, but of course with the advent of the Third Reich, it shifted roles. The back courtyard was used for deportation until 1941. And this was in the east side of Berlin. So this was just a regular East German school for a long time. And for decades, from the 50s, 60s, I think, stood empty. 1 year ago, it was reopened as a restaurant, or two restaurants and several galleries.
It's a pretty special space, and I can attest to the strength of the cuisine. I've had quite a few dumpling soups so far, matzoball soups. It's working very well for me because it is rather brisk for me. I'm only used to London's much more gentle winters. But we've got lots coming up on the show today. We're going to be talking to Quentin Peel from the Financial Times very shortly. We've got architect Matthias Saalbrook joining us, Jess Erickson as well from General Assembly, and plenty more besides. It's going to be a fun-packed 60 minutes here on this special edition of Midori House, live from very cold and occasionally snowy Berlin, right here on Monocle 24. So you're with Midori House live from Berlin. Now, more than any other nation in Europe, Germany has the economic and financial clout to steer the Eurozone through the choppy waters of the ongoing economic crisis. Its current growth story perhaps distances it from its closest European allies, whose outlook is less rosy. You can tell the outlook's pretty rosy here because of all the cocktails that are being made in the background. But what about Germany's neighbours?
France's growth and deficit reduction targets are both under what it projected. Italy's election next week will provoke political uncertainty, not least because Silvio Berlusconi is back in the picture. While Spain's financial corruption scandal is undermining the legitimacy of Mariano Rajoy's administration, not so rosy at all.
So will Germany's growth distance it from its neighbours? And how will it throw its weight behind its close allies to support the Eurozone? Well, Quentin Peel, Berlin Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, joins us now. Quentin, welcome to this special edition of Midori House. I'd like to start by asking you that question. Do you think that there is some conflict then between Germany continuing in fairly robust fashion economically, the likes of France, you know, a key partner in this sort of European project, continuing to struggle? What kind of challenges does that pose for Germany?
Very big ones, I think, really. It's pulling these two key drivers of the whole Eurozone apart. The truth is that Germany has slowed down a bit recently. It's feeling the pinch too, although, as you say, you might not think it if you're sitting in Berlin. Germans on the whole are feeling pretty comfortable. The labour market's looking pretty good. Unemployment's low. Youth unemployment, which is, 56% in Spain at the moment, is about 6% in Germany. So you're talking about a complete contrast in performance, which means that actually, when you come down to it, Germans don't really understand why they should be fessing up quite so much money to bail out all their neighbours. And that tension, I think, is still very much there. The key is going to be France. At the end of the day, can France pull itself round? And you've got a left-wing government in France and a right-wing government in Germany. That's François Hollande wanting to have more growth and Angela Merkel want to have more savings cut back on debts. So they don't really understand each other very well. So there's lots of reason for a bumpy ride. But in your introduction, you said one very important thing, and that was Germany wants the euro to survive and will pay almost anything to do that. And we shouldn't forget it.
I just wondered then, it's interesting you make that comparison between Merkel and Hollande. What do you think the situation would be like for Germany if Merkel was enjoying a less robust domestic political scene? If she was under the same kind of pressure as, say, Hollande was under, would that then threaten the whole project? Could it start to unravel? Or do you think that it would endure even if things were rockier at home for her?
She's a very interesting politician. She reads her country very well. And this is a woman who, after all, spent the first 35 years of her life under communist rule. She wasn't in the West. She came to politics very late. She's a scientist. But she's sort of slow and steady. And she's absolutely convinced that the way to sainthood, if you like, is to save your money. Be very careful. Be a Swabian housewife. We don't blow the money on bad debts and things. And what she's got right for the Germans is this combination. She's pro-European, but she defends the German national interest. It's the perfect mix in Germany. So there she is, this politician who's sailing through the crisis, more and more popular all the time.
You just, in the Financial Times of December, you did a long piece on her. Do you see anything that could challenge this domestic popularity of hers?
Well, she's made one very rash decision in the last 3 years, and that was what they call the energy change, the Energiewende in Germany. She basically said, we're getting out of nuclear energy as fast as we can by 2021. If that goes wrong and energy prices start to rocket through the roof in Germany, they're going to suddenly become much less competitive globally. And as you know, Germany depends on its exports, exports to China, exports all over the world. If Germany becomes very expensive quickly, that could rebound against her. So that's one problem. I think otherwise, she has an extraordinary instinct. The Germans like a rather dull politician, and, you know, let's be clear, Angela Merkel doesn't do fancy dresses and nice shoes. She is dumpy and dull, but she's very straight, and that's exactly what the Germans like. She looks you in the eye and says, this is the situation.
I'm interested then in her relationships with some of the other kind of power brokers within the European Union, if not in the actual Eurozone. What's her relationship like, in your view, with David Cameron? Is it, do you think, a pragmatic relationship? You know, the UK, it's a kind of necessary, awkward byproduct that has to be there all the time. Is it chilly, a bit frosty, the relationship? How would you characterise it?
It's fascinating. When I came here 3 years ago, I was convinced that this was actually going to be a poisonous personal relationship, because David Cameron had walked his Conservative Party out of Mrs. Merkel's political family, the European People's Party. And she tried to stop him, and he'd gone. And I thought, they'll never get it right again. She is so pragmatic, she literally turned round on a pin and said, OK, how else do I do business with this guy? And the truth is that everything I hear is they get on quite well, but only up to a certain point. And this is where I think David Cameron's in danger of persuading himself that he can get away with anything with Angela Merkel. No. Angela Merkel says the answer to this crisis is more Europe. And David Cameron says the answer to this crisis is less Europe. And there is a big dividing line.
And if we turn then to the sort of domestic political scene in Germany, obviously we've got elections not too far away. What would be your sort of best guess of what we might see? Do you think that some of the, I suppose you could call them setbacks in terms of regional elections the last few months, do you think we'll see that come September, or what's your sort of anticipation? It's rather hard to gaze into the crystal ball, I understand, but what would be your best guess?
Angela Merkel is going to come top. She is fantastically popular. She's got popularity way over 60%. You know, her predecessor, the last conservative Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Kohl, never had popularity above 20%. She's way over 60%. So that's something rather special. But having said that, she doesn't know who her partner's going to be in the future. And so you've got a big range from, on the right, the current partner, the Liberals, who are looking in complete meltdown. In the middle, you've got the Social Democrats. This would be a grand coalition. It must be the most likely outcome, left and right. But actually, there is a really possible outcome, which would be the Greens with Frau Merkel. And that would be a very interesting conversation. It's never really been tried before. And it would be, I think, very conservative, because the Greens, in terms of wanting to have slow growth and not spend anybody, their children's money and so on, are very conservative at one side. But they're also quite left-wing in terms of being pacifist and socially liberal. And the Christian Democrats, Merkel's party, very Christian, rather conservative. It could be a very interesting but untried combination. So actually this election is going to be fascinating. September the 22nd, we'll see what the outcome is.
Now, Quentin, while you're here, I would like to ask you this. We've obviously got our March issue of Monocle. It's a German special. And one of the questions we ask in that is about sort of how Germany sees itself in the world, how Germans see themselves, and how there's certain stereotypes which maybe are true or not. And sometimes there may be a bit of a reluctance on the part of some Germans to celebrate all that's great about Germany and all of its contributions. I just wonder, as a long-time resident now, what's your view of that? Do you think that Germany is a country, in broad terms, that still has trouble selling itself and being confident about itself? Or do you think that that has changed in the last few years?
It's changed a little bit, but not entirely. Germany is a country that is not very comfortable with itself precisely because of its history. And it's a country that's very conscious of its history and says, we never want to go back there again. So when it comes down to it, Germany is economically and should be politically the most powerful country in Europe. It isn't politically, because it doesn't want to be. Germany wants to be a big Switzerland. It wants to be sort of comfortable and neutral and nice and not bothering anybody. And they've been thrust into this situation where, perhaps precisely because of the decline of Britain and France, suddenly Germany is being urged to be more of a political leader. They don't feel comfortable with that at all in Germany. And so you get this constant tension, I think, between the economic role, which is very powerful, and back again as the largest exporter, even bigger than China, and yet politically a dwarf, really. So a constant tension, which I think makes this country absolutely fascinating and also rather civilized. They don't want to bully people.
So tell me then, Quentin, what does the future hold for Frau Merkel then? Assuming that all things go according to plan in September, how does she reconcile that? Because as you say, the financial kind of burden on Germany will presumably continue to a greater or lesser extent. There is that pressure then to become, as you said, more of a political heart as well as just the geographical and economic heart of Europe. How does she manage that? How does she manage people's expectations? What's going to be the secret to manage that in the next, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years?
She has two utterly dreadful phrases she uses all the time. One is, there is no alternative, and the other is, step by step. She goes slowly, she goes calmly, she doesn't get anybody overexcited, she doesn't do the vision thing. She just says, all these problems we've got, the financial problems we've got, are only going to be solved in the long term. She's a physicist. She likes to look at things in a fundamental way, saying, what's the fundamental reason things are going wrong? Well, let's try and answer that. And by being a physicist, she's got one other very interesting difference to other politicians, where a normal politician says, I've chosen the right way to go, and then if they get thwarted, it's a disaster. Merkel regards everything as a scientific experiment. You go to the left and it doesn't work, I'll try to the right. She's desperately pragmatic, and that seems to be how she'll survive. I would say she's going to get elected for another term as Chancellor, and then I wouldn't be at all surprised if she moves on to the European stage and actually goes for one of the big European jobs, which she's an absolute natural for, because she's a natural chairperson. She sits there and knocks people's heads together and just basically gets them in line. And the truth is, when you come down to it, she may be rather unpopular in Greece at the moment, but right across Europe, this woman is remarkably popular. People sort of respect her, and she doesn't frighten them. And that's another very good thing for Germany today. She's not hammering the table. She's just gentle.
Well, Quentin Peel of the Financial Times, on that point, I think we shall leave it. Thank you very much for joining us on our special Midori House show today.
Coming up, we sit down with one major player from Berlin's thriving design and architecture scene, Matthias Sauerbruch, to find out why the German capital remains a hub for the creative community.
Europe's first big election of 2013 takes place next weekend as Italy goes to the polls. And on Monocle 24, we've got it covered. This week, we'll be reporting from across Italy, getting under the skin of one of the continent's most fascinating countries. Every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily, we'll analyse the big issues and the even bigger personalities. That's the Italian election, all this week on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be taking the temperature of Berlin's architecture scene with Matthias Sauerbruch in just a moment. But before we do, ahead of tomorrow's briefing show, the Monocle team in Berlin wanted to take the diplomatic pulse of Germany.
We headed to the Michael Wilford and Partner designed UK embassy on Wilhelmstrasse to catch up with the British ambassador to Germany, Simon MacDonald. We wanted to find out what it's like to be the diplomat to the nation right at the heart, in every respect, as we've been hearing, of Europe. And whether, with the advantages of today's communications technology, face-to-face contact still conducts a higher premium in the world of diplomacy.
Looking at Germany then, it's obviously sort of geographically at the heart of Europe. It's always been very much at the centre of the European project. Is your experience, having lived and worked here over the last couple of years, that, anecdotally at least, that is still the case in terms of how Germans see their place in Europe?
Yes, Germany has 9 neighbours. And it's the first article of its foreign policy that it has good relations with all those neighbours. And the main vehicle for that is the European Union. And Germans see that we, the United Kingdom, are an island on the edge of the continent with a different history, a history that is more engaged with the rest of the world than with the European continent. So they see that we come at the issues of the 21st century with different backgrounds. But they and we think that these different backgrounds can be blended and that we can work closely together.
Do you still place a great deal of value on, if you like, the traditional diplomacy, the bricks and mortar, the face-to-face meetings? Are you one of these digital diplomacy converts? It's popular, but is it as effective?
I think you have to combine them. I remember from my student days reading that when the electric telegraph was invented, people thought this would make such a difference to the way people worked that there would be no need for embassies overseas anymore. So Queen Victoria suggested that we did not need a new embassy in Madrid because we could handle the relationship direct. Well, it turns out that technology is not the be-all and end-all. I think personal contact is still the core of diplomacy. Information is not the issue. Information you can get very quickly, but interpretation and prioritization, they still require people, they still require expertise, and that, I think, is where diplomats come in.
And you can hear the full version of that interview with British Ambassador to Germany, Simon MacDonald, on tomorrow's briefing. Also coming to you, you lucky people, live from Berlin at midday London time, 1300, of course, here in Germany.
Architecture and design are two aspects of Berlin's cultural and urban tapestry that make the German capital such an exciting city. It's an urban landscape inextricably connected to its recent history, at once still architecturally divided along the lines of East and West, and doubly defined by the history and modernity of its buildings, old and new.
One architecture firm at the forefront of innovative design evident in Germany's new builds is Sauerbruch-Hutten, the company that built the first high-rise after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and one that continues to focus on the green and colourful approach to building across Germany. Sauerbruch-Hutten offer an insight into what it's like to work across the different urban landscapes of the nation. And Matthias Sauerbruch, co-founder of Sauerbruch-Hutten Architects, joins us now. Matthias, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us here at Pauli Saal. I wanted to start by asking you about the kind of big picture of planning, urban planning, here in Berlin. In terms of the really big projects in the city, do you think the city's doing a good job?
Well, you have to understand that Berlin, having been separated and sort of been living in a sort of special status for, you know, 50 years or so, was really dominated by a kind of more or less centralist kind of planning mentality, in the East in any case, but the West was more or less comparable. And of course, after reunification, now all of this changes, and the city is still very much in transition as far as these kind of processes are going. I think at the moment it's more going towards a kind of open, kind of participatory, and also kind of, you know, stakeholder-oriented mentality, whereas for quite a long time, the city was very much dominated by very strict guidelines in terms of planning.
Could you mention what some of those guidelines were? I mean, I'm thinking of projects like Potsdamer Platz.
Yes, I mean, of course, I mean, Berlin in particular is also totally paranoid about its history, and the city is actually quite young. I mean, it only grew into a metropolis at around 1750, 1800, something like that, and it really grew in the late 19th century. So between 1870 and 1920, the city quintupled, I mean, five times its size. So most of the building stock is of that period, and compared to other European capitals like London, Paris, Lisbon, Stockholm, you name it, I mean, it's a young city. It's almost like an American city. So it has already, because of that, maybe a little bit, you could say, a chip on its shoulder. It sort of feels maybe a kind of certain lack of history. But then, of course, through the fascist period and the destruction through the war and so on and so forth, this lack has become even more apparent. And so there's a generation, which is roughly the 68 generation, which is very keen to somehow bring back a sense of history, bring back a kind of certain completeness. And you were asking for some of the planning guidelines. I mean, there was a wish to bring back the most dominant typology, which is the block. I mean, block buildings which are lining the streets and forming very clear urban public spaces, in a way, to reconstruct that all over the city. And you probably have heard about the debate around the Schloss, the kind of castle that is meant to be reconstructed, even though it's been totally destroyed in the 1950s.
So how hard is it then to have a kind of a coherent strategy, a citywide strategy, when you have this past that is so fractured? There's been so much fracture, both, you know, literally in the landscape and kind of ideologically. Is it possible then to have a coherent, a unified approach then to developing a city with that background?
In my view, thankfully not, because, I mean, the city is just much too diverse. The problems are too manifold, and the stakeholders and kind of people who are involved in all building construction, planning and so on are so diverse that thankfully there's no dominant tendency in the end. However, having said that, there's been a debate which was very much dominated by this wish of a certain degree of reconstruction, and that in a way was blocking, I think in my view, was slightly blocking the development. But that's over in a way, and I think at the moment there's quite a bit of dynamism in particular in Berlin, and sort of small initiatives happening all over the place. It's not a place for such big projects. I mean, there are a few big projects such as the airport, and you all have read about this in the paper, but the where it's interesting, where it's happening, is the smaller projects, really. And of course there are a lot of designers and planners and creative people in the city who are working elsewhere, not necessarily in Berlin.
On that note, a question I'd love to ask you is how the different cities in Berlin deal with their urban fabric. I know you've built in Frankfurt, you built the Museum Brandhorst in Munich, you've got a big project in Hamburg which may or may not be finished.
Nearly finished,
Wilhelmsburg.
Yes.
What was it like dealing as an architect with the different city typologies, or what are the differences in the guidelines?
It's I think it's less the city typologies, it's more the mentality. I mean, Germany is very regional. I mean, it has, you know, the different Bundesländer, the different federal countries have different histories, different, even slightly different language, and certainly different mentality, and that also plays out in the city. So, I mean, if you're building in Hamburg, you're just meeting a totally different mentality from, say, Munich, for example. I mean, in tendency, the kind of north-south sort of preconception probably holds true in that the south is more relaxed, everything is much more in flux. It's, I guess, Munich always sees itself as the kind of most northern city of Italy, and there's a little bit of truth in that. Whereas obviously Berlin is, the history is Prussian, and it's all more organized, and it's kind of maybe slightly less creative as from the starting point. But having said that, Berlin having undergone such a kind of drastic history, such drastic changes, I mean, it's now become very cosmopolitan and it's very open.
I'd just like to ask you about the sort of the rise of kind of green initiatives, ecologically responsible design, both in terms of architecture and urban planning. How much a part of the process then in the sort of modern Germany has that become? I know you and the practice of yourself and your wife was quite in the vanguard of that movement in a lot of ways. Is that something now that's really fundamental to a lot of new projects, do you think?
I think so. I mean, obviously, politically speaking, the German Green Party was one of the first Green parties altogether, and the Green movement is quite strong in Germany, and that, of course, also somehow is reflected in architecture and urban planning. Also, I mean, Germany is an export economy, and building components and building technology play a big part. And, you know, it being also a comparatively expensive country in terms of production and so on, you have to compete with ideas rather than cheap labor. So there's a big interest to somehow develop this field and kind of just come up with intelligent ideas.
Matthias Saalbruch of Saalbruch Hutton Architects, many thanks indeed for joining us here on Midori House. You're listening to the special edition of the show, live from the bar of Palisal on Berlin's Augerstrasse. In the next half hour of the programme, we welcome Jess Eriksson, co-founder of Kiketz and Berlin producer of the New York co-working space General Assembly, to the show. Plus, we lay our collective heads down in one hotel offering a deep sleep package, the only of its kind in Berlin.
We have an inner clock that tells us to be awake during the daytime, in the evening time to calm down and to get tired and to go to bed and sleep. And a lot of people got out of touch with that inner clock.
So all of that and plenty more still to come. But first, here's David Spencer with the latest international news headlines.
Thank you. South African police have replaced the lead detective handling the Oscar Pistorius investigation. Hilton Botha was removed from the case after it was revealed he faces 7 counts of attempted murder over an incident in 2009. Botha's handling of the investigation was criticised by defence lawyers this week, claiming he'd made several fundamental mistakes. The athlete denies murdering his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, saying that he shot her in error, thinking she was an intruder. Dozens of people have been killed after a massive car bomb explosion in the Syrian capital, Damascus. It happened near the headquarters of Syria's ruling Ba'ath Party. At least 11 people have been killed in a pair of explosions in the Indian city of Hyderabad. The blast happened 10 minutes apart near a crowded market area. Dozens more were injured. 3 people have died after gunshots fired from a car in Las Vegas forced a Maserati to crash into a taxi, creating a fireball. Police are hunting the occupants of a black Range Rover where the gunshots are said to have come from. 30,000 workers have staged a demonstration in Brussels against austerity measures planned by the Belgian government. Expressing anger at wage cuts and tax rises, they marched across the city in one of the biggest protests to take place over budget restrictions. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Kimberly Bradley. Now, how are you feeling? Could you use a nap right about now? Is a failure to catch up on REM sleep leaving you a little, well, short of energy? We might have some good news for you right here in Berlin.
Just in case you'd like to get better sleep than usual while visiting the city, the Swiss Hotel offers the Deep Sleep Package, the only one of its kind that helps guests psychologically and physically regenerate through a special combination of light and aromatherapy, power napping, nutritional supplements, and a sound pillow. I'm getting sleepy already.
Reporter Melanie Shevchenko met with sleep doctor Samia Little-Elk at the hotel to learn what exactly is keeping guests up and how these new treatments can help lull them off to the land of nod.
We sleep a third of our whole life. Sleep is important. We regenerate physically, emotionally. When we don't sleep right, we get ill emotionally and physically. This topic is really a big topic in the public right now.
This is Dr. Samia Little-Elk, a therapist and sleep analyst who runs a sleep consultation practice, along with TV doctor and somnologist, Dr. Michelle Feld. As a promotion, the Swiss Hotel offers the Deep Sleep Package, a scientific concept developed by Dr. Feld to get guests sleeping better.
the package is supposed to synchronize you again with your inner clock. We have an inner clock that tells us to be awake during the daytime, in the evening time to calm down and to get tired and to go to bed and sleep. And a lot of people got out of touch with that inner clock. So what the Deep Sleep package is doing, it has components in it that are helping you to synchronize again with that inner clock.
In the morning, guests start with light therapy for about 30 minutes. Which stops the sleep hormone production in the brain.
This is the bright light. It has like 10,000 lux, which is really bright. It's not a lamp you would buy to put in your household. This is the kind of light that you need to have an effect, a physical effect. So it simulates sunlight. And it's important to do this in the morning because in the evening it would keep you away from sleeping.
Next, room service brings you a wake-up drink of herbal tea and fresh mint. In the afternoon, you get a chance to relax in the power napping room on the first floor, where memory foam mattresses form to your body and muscles, and iPods pump you full of dreamy music. Come evening time, you're served a calming drink, a warm, milk-based concoction with lavender and natural flavors.
The Deep Sleep package also comes with a room smell. So this is taken from the aromatherapy because we know our brain, our emotions, everything reacts to smells. So you can use certain aromas to feel better, to feel freshened up or to calm down. So in the morning you have a fresh lemony kind of orangey kind of smell. And in the evening you have a calming lavender based smell. Then for the sleeping, we have a sound pillow, which sounds funny. It's actually relaxing music coming out of the speakers that are built into a pillow, but they're not just relaxing music. There is something called binaural beats in the music that you cannot hear consciously, but your brain registers them. These beats, they're like the frequencies that our brain waves go through during different sleep phases. So the idea is that if your brain got out of balance and has trouble falling into these sleep patterns, by listening to the music and the binaural beats under it, you find a better sleep and more relaxing sleep.
Wow, so this is actually being played while I'm sleeping?
Yeah, of course. You turn it as quiet as possible so it doesn't bother you, and you can lay on the pillow, but you can also lay beside it. That's okay. It feels good when you lay on it too.
Yeah, that actually feels really nice. It's like this memory foam almost. But I wasn't expecting the sound pillow to be such an epic like orchestra, I guess.
It is.
It's very orchestral, yes.
Exactly. But it picks you up at a more excited level, which is good, because if it starts too calm, you're too nervous to fall along, you know? So it's good if it starts a little bit more exciting and then it gets more calm, more slower, more quieter.
The Deep Sleep package is offered with or without a sleep analysis. Some guests just want the perks of the therapy to achieve a sounder sleep, while others might decide to get the full consultation. This means meeting with Dr. Little Elk to discuss your sleeping problems or habits, and then getting suited up with a small head device before bedtime. Dr. Little Elk says typically people come for a consultation with one of three major issues. The first is insomnia, while the second is sleeping at night but still feeling burnt out or tired during the day, which could be related to an underlying emotional problem.
The third problem is snorers, people that snore. And as you can imagine, sometimes it's, or a lot of times, it's not the person that snores that is coming to us. So it's the partner that's laying next to them. It says, you have to do something. I can't sleep. I have to sleep in a different room. Something's wrong. Or they even say, he doesn't only snore. Every now and then he just stops breathing. And then I get scared and then I kick him a little bit and wake him up a little bit so he breathes again. And so we're hinting at apnea here, which can be a severe problem and cause a lot of physical and also mentally, emotionally problems.
Sleep, according to the doctor, is a topic that is becoming increasingly popular as society demands that we stay available and connected all the time.
I think we got a little bit arrogant about it. We thought we don't need it. We can live with less sleep, or there's a lot of pressure in the society. You have to work to make a living. Some people have to work two jobs and they come home late at night. And then a big factor is the light, artificial light that we have now that can keep us up. Naturally, we listen to the day and night, to sunlight and darkness. Those are the things that synchronize us with our inner clock. And the light that we have is one factor that throws us out of this balance that is naturally there. The other thing is that we're used to being connected all the time. You have your smartphone with you wherever you go. You're always in contact with people, and sometimes employers actually expect that. You answer emails all the time, and that keeps us up. We don't calm down. We don't work physically throughout the day, and we're not tired enough in the evening, or even if we're tired, we're emotionally so worked up that we don't take time to calm down, and then we can't sleep.
So from a marketing standpoint, hotels are starting to catch on to the wellness trend by offering spa promotions or specially designed mattresses to optimize sleep. One particularly fascinating anecdote is the pillow menu, which allows guests to choose the pillow that is right for them, like the Swiss pine that gives off a soothing scent of resin and reduces perspiration around the head and neck, while the heat-regulating cotton-covered spelt pillow eases tension in the back and neck. But having the possibility to consult with a doctor that is specialized in sleep medicine is a unique opportunity.
Everybody enjoys it, but not everybody is sleeping 100% after this. This is not doing any miracles. If somebody is not sleeping right for 10 years, 15 years, just by giving them certain wellness products, that might not fix their insomnia. That's why we have the practice here, and we can check the sleep of these people, and we can sometimes do more severe treatments that can help them.
But in the meantime, powering down the devices might help to power down the mind for a smoother transition into deep sleep. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
You're listening to a special edition of Midori House, broadcast to you live from our temporary Monocle studio home in the toasty warm interior of Polisal, a former Jewish girls' school turned restaurant, bar and cultural centre. We'll be back with a look at the reasons behind the veritable blossoming flower that is Berlin's tech scene.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Todd Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Inspiration comes from finding new ventures that combine traditions with an original contemporary approach, especially when it comes to food. Monocle Films visits Toronto, Lisbon, and Thessaloniki to discover some sweet recipes for success.
Nadege, along with her small but dedicated crew of pastry chefs, create every morsel on site in a large open kitchen connected to the main dining area. It's here that they balance flavor with color, texture with geometry, and creativity with shelf appeal.
Taste with your eyes on monocle.com.
Now we're looking at the city's reputation as a tech hub next, and in particular, looking at the expansion to the capital of the New York-based co-working space General Assembly. Since last year, the Berlin producer of General Assembly, Jess Erickson, has been spreading the word here, and the space in this city, like its London outpost, is focused on education, collaborative learning.
So why does Berlin foster these sorts of communities? And with initiatives like General Assembly following other successes like SoundCloud in building a big tech reputation in the city, what will the next steps for the sector look like?
I'm delighted to say that Jess is joining us now. Jess, welcome to this special Midori House here at Polisal. I guess that's an interesting place to start. What do you think it is about the atmosphere in Berlin that makes it so conducive to the world of the startup?
Well, there are some more obvious and less obvious reasons. Of course, I look at Berlin as a very immigrant-friendly city. The fact that we are in EU, but it's very easy to get a visa here as an American expat rather than going to the UK, where it takes a lot of work to get in. So that's first and foremost. Second, of course, is the cheap costs. the fact that you are a startup bootstrapping, you don't have a whole lot of money, but you do need to hire a lot of employees, you won't be able to pay as much. So Berlin really is a great place to set up shop. You get a nice big space for a sizable startup for really nothing.
When did the momentum really start? It seems like there are tremendous numbers of startups right now, and the numbers keep growing.
Yeah, I mean, they say the startup scene technically began 5 years ago, but we really see this upward trajectory in the last 9 months. I've been here for 2 years, and I've seen tremendous growth just looking around. Every week I meet someone new coming in from France, Spain, Italy, the United States, Australia, all wanting to set up shop and create a company here. And at last I heard in a Bloomberg report there was roughly 500 startups in Berlin.
Now, let's talk a little bit about General Assembly. How's it all been going? How are the courses running since it got started? Are they sort of packed out? What's the attendance like, and how's it all faring?
It's actually quite strong. Just as we had predicted, Berlin would be a great place to set up shop. So right now we are in 8 cities, but Berlin is the newest city that we've set an outpost in. We launched in November, and we probably have roughly between 30 and 50 students per class and workshop. We also have these really long 10-week intensive immersion courses in front-end web development and UX design. So we plan to keep expanding, increasing the amount of classes we offer, both online and offline. And we hope to educate all of Berlin.
Who comes to the classes? Is it natives? Is it expats? Is it a mix?
It's a mixture. I'd say a lot of internationals are in attendance, and largely to do with the fact that our courses are offered in English right now. But in the next quarter, we will be offering German classes in design, business, and tech. So we might see an increase in German attendance. But largely, I would say most of them are entrepreneurs, startup employees, people who just want to transition out of their company and want to try something new, gain a new skill set, or improve one. So it is a really diverse background of individuals that are participating, which makes it interesting learning environment.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the Geekettes.
Yes.
Now, this is another interesting group, sort of mentors women in the tech industry. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how that came about, and what kind of pressure was there to start up an initiative like that? Because do you feel very strongly that this is a kind of a sector where there is a sort of gender divide that needs a bit of a sort of heavy approach to really make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg is one of my personal mentors, and I read everything that she writes. And if you think about it, Facebook has about 60% of women using their platform every day. So there should be female engineers building these products and understanding the way that women think and how these online products should work. So when I came to Germany, I realized there really weren't a whole lot of women in this tech scene. And I thought, okay, maybe we need to start a group to create a nice cast of role models that young ladies can look up to and say, hey, you know, after graduating, I could start my own company, or I could be an engineer at SoundCloud. So it's really been a place and a source of inspiration. We're now a group of 450 women, and in 2 weeks we launch our first all-women's hackathon. I think it's the first one in Germany, where we will spend 3 days hacking and creating products. We've partnered with Deutsche Telekom and SoundCloud for this, so we're super excited.
Big question, is there more money to be invested into tech startups now in Germany than there was in the past?
Yes, I do agree that investment funds are coming in, and largely to do with the fact that I hosted a fundraising capital conference last Friday. I had investors coming in from London, from Wellington Partners, Index Ventures, you name it. We had a series of conversations, and there's definitely a strong interest in investing here. You can see most recently with Six Wunderkinder, who attracted $4.2 million an investment from Atomico Ventures. Now that's the first, real German original company in recent times to pull that kind of an investment from outside of Germany. Same as SoundCloud, Gitsy, Readmill. All of these young international startups really can pull decent Series A funding rounds.
And Jess, I want to ask you just briefly about then your optimism for the future. It's obviously, it looks like it's boom time in terms of tech startup. How optimistic are you in the sort of medium-term future that a lot of these newer businesses are going to endure? They're going to go from strength to strength. Do you still see enough in the markets, enough in the sort of fabric of the economy that you know, these things will be robust and healthy in 12 months, 18 months, 2 years from now.
Yes, absolutely. When you see so much international talent coming in from all over the world and setting up shop here in Berlin, what it does is it attracts more and more talent, it attracts investors, it attracts big businesses who might want to acquire these young startups. So in that essence, given this surge of startup growth, I can only see it growing and growing in the next few years.
Fantastic stuff. Jess Erickson, many thanks for coming on to this special edition of Midori House here at Pauli Cell. There'll be more on the good and bad of the local Berlin tech scene on tomorrow's Berlin-based briefing show, coming to you live at noon London time, 1300 hours here, local, of course. Up next, we'll be hearing from Charlie Wobken, president of the legendary German Babelsberg Film Studios, right after this. You're listening to a special Midori House live from Berlin with me, Tom Edwards, and Kimberly Bradley. Now, on February the 12th, 1912, the camera rolled for the first time in Studio Babelsberg, the world's oldest large-scale studios. Sitting on the outskirts of Berlin, this movie-making complex managed to survive four turbulent political systems in Germany, and today it boasts state-of-the-art facilities that have attracted big-budget international productions like Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds and The Reader, starring Oscar winner Kate Winslet.
While Monocle's executive producer Gillian Tobias was filming in Berlin last week, she had the opportunity to visit the legendary studios and sit down with Charlie Wobken, Babelsberg Studios president and CEO.
It's impossible to walk through the gates of Studio Babelsberg without feeling a shiver of excitement at the cinema history that was made here. It was here that Fritz Lang directed his German expressionist science fiction film Metropolis in 1927. And just over a decade later, Marlene Dietrich was starring in Joseph von Strindberg's The Blue Angel. In its 100-year history, Studio Babelsberg has been a magnet for auteur directors such as Pasolini, Polanski, and more recently Tom Twyker and Wes Anderson, who's currently shooting his latest production, The Grand Budapest Hotel, at Babelsberg. Film industry veteran Charlie Wobken was so drawn to the studio's provenance and its potential that in 2004, together with his business associate, Christoph Fieser, he bought Babelsberg from the French media group Vivendi. For Wobken, the studio-director relationship is key.
When you look into the histories of studios, quite often the relationship that the studio has to directors is the most important one. Actors and producers aren't that important. Producers, they normally act in a way that they say we go where the money is, where we have the lowest production cost. And actors actually often don't have a choice, because they have to go where the producer and the director say that's where we shoot the film. So the director relationship is very important. And we try to really deal with that as good as we can. We put a lot of effort and time into that, into networking with international film directors.
The power of film to buoy a region's economy has film commissions around the world competitively courting Hollywood producers. In addition to generous national and regional subsidies available in Germany, the country's track record for efficiency and quality workmanship is the trump card up Wobken's cinematic sleeve.
You can't compare it, I think, with other branches like car building or computer industries. Filmmaking still is a handcraft business, and you need to transport that business from one generation to the other. And that has happened in Babelsberg and never got lost, fortunately, knowing that the studio went through different political systems, and it might have well been shut down for a while, and then it would have been very difficult to reopen again and to get back to the skills. And fortunately, that didn't happen. The efficiency that we claim we have might help a little bit. But the efficiency is not only just the, let's say, the labor attitude and method in which we work. It also has to do with the studio structure. Babelsberg was built for huge films a long time ago. And because of that vast space that we have to prep a film and then to build up and knock down sets, for example, overnight, That is something which is very important on big films, because on a big film, a day will cost about $1 million. And if you lose a day, or if you shoot a day longer, you can lose $1 million. And that is very important on big films. So in combination of the structure that we have and maybe the working methods, it is an advantage that helps a little bit.
Babelsberg Studios are more than just facilities to service big budget productions. They also act as executive producers, committed to investing in film productions to strengthen Germany's film industry.
The crew base in Germany, they either work for German film producers or for international films. And I believe they learn quite a lot from international films. The big films are basically the films where new technologies and new ways of filmmaking develop from, rather than from German films. And I think that is important also for German filmmakers and producers if they want to export their product in the long run, and that should be the goal. And I think basically, as the German film producers can learn from our knowledge in international film production, as well as we can learn with international partners from German filmmakers, because they are quite flexible in the way they produce. It's a different setup. When you don't have that much money, you have to produce more flexible. And that is something which is more and more important also for film budgets. Budgets have to come down, and methods of filmmaking have to adjust to that. And I think German filmmakers can contribute to that to a certain degree.
Cinema is in the DNA of Berlin, and the city is an important element in the creative filmmaking equation here.
I think it is quite important. Specifically after the reunification, Berlin became a magnet for many creative people to work here. Berlin has a very nice creative environment for all kinds of artists, also for filmmakers, and is still quite affordable compared to other large cities. So Berlin has a very nice spirit since the reunification, it still has. This is one thing. The other thing is also that Berlin has a large variety of locations that you can use for filmmaking. And since Berlin is still in a, I would say still in a building up and restructuring phase, there are still lots of locations that you can use which have not been modernized yet. Quite often modern cities have the problem that it's very difficult to get shooting permissions, and that is something which is quite shooting friendly over here. You know, all the pictures which are shot in Germany on German locations is a possibility to export pictures from Germany into other countries. It really encourages and improves tourism and other branches, which is good for the economy of the country. And therefore, it's not only culture which is transported through film, it has also to do with showing the world what the country is about. For example, when we had Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes on Valkyrie in Berlin for a couple of months, the newspapers all over the world were full of that, of that name Berlin. And so the name Berlin was transported into all countries, and that is something which other media cannot do that easily. Film, big tentpole films transport a lot of these things into the world, and that is, I think, something which is of value. It's not of big economical value, but I think it's a large image value which can be improved by that.
That was Charlie Vobkin, President and CEO of Studio Babelsberg, talking with Gillian Tobias. And Gillian's film on the Berlin cinema scene will soon be premiering on Monocle.com, so do check that out and take a look. And that, I have to say, is all we have time for on this special German edition of Midori House. My thanks, of course, to our producer, Alad John, to Toby Hammond, manning the desk here in Berlin, and to our studio manager in London, Alex Funnel. We'll be back for more Berlin action at 1300 hours Central European time tomorrow. The show is going to be packed. But for now, from the heart of Berlin, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Kimberly Bradley.
It's goodbye. Thanks for listening.